Welcome to the Battle Archive. Since 2005, the Academy of Ideas has organised the Battle of Ideas Festival, with debates on the key cultural, political and scientific issues of the day. We are proud to be the home for unfettered debate, the People's Parliament, the place where new ideas come alive in open discussion. And now, we are opening our vault, making our recordings of public debate available to you, free to revisit and share as often as you like. For more free speech content and news on our next festival, subscribe below or head to academyofideas.org.uk. But for now, enjoy the discussion.
Welcome to this opening plenary, Is There a Future for Liberalism? My name's Claire Fox, I'm the director of the Institute of Ideas. It's really nice to see you all. Just to kind of set the scene a little before I introduce the panel, and it's very brief. When Nick Clegg, people are saying, who's he? Anyway, resigned as leader of the Lib Dems after the electoral wipeout, he said, liberalism here, as well as across Europe, is not faring well against the politics of fear. Fear and grievance has won, liberalism has lost. But it is more precious than ever, and we must keep fighting for it. So I rarely agreed with Nick Clegg, but I do think that he has a point about the plight of liberalism. And don't worry, this debate is not about the Lib Dems, but I thought it was an interesting thing to note that the party that represented liberal values apparently has been more or less wiped off the electoral map here in the UK. I also think as well, though, that it shows that liberalism is something that we can be quite confused about. I want to stand in the spirit of the Enlightenment sense of liberalism and its values, and yet I also use the term liberal as an insult very often and sort of say, oh, those liberals who do this, those liberals. And it's usually when I'm talking about people who are being censorious. And I suddenly realise that the concept of illiberal liberals is actually well and truly alive today. So it seems to me that the whole of Western values is established on liberalism, and its fate, where we are now, is an important discussion, which is really what this panel is about. There's no right and wrong answers, but I think it's an important thing for us to try and get to grips with and to understand. So I'm going to introduce the speakers in the order in which they'll speak. For those of you who have not been to the festival before and not familiar with the format, it goes like this. Fairly strict timekeeping from the panel. They've got 5 to 7 minutes to speak. And then, really, we're opening up a public conversation. We're going to go out to you and get a few points, but then use that to have a panel discussion, then go out and get more points, then come back out. It's not a Q&A. They're not here as experts. They're actually here as interesting people to give us a provocative opening to make us think. So the order in which they'll speak are Professor Frank Frady, who's a sociologist and social commentator of international renown. He's the author of Power of Reading, From Socrates to Twitter, which he's launching at this festival tomorrow. And he's also the author of many books, including The Politics of Fear, On Tolerance, relevant today, and Authority, A Sociological History. But check out his bio because it's very impressive. He's a battle regular. Give him a warm welcome. We're delighted to have him. Next up, we're going to hear from Dr. Katrina Forrester, who is a lecturer in the history of political thought at Queen Mary University, London. Her research focuses on the history of 20th century thought. She's currently completing her first book, Reinventing Morality. It's the first time at the battle. I also see from her biography that she's doing research or has done research on things like the history of feminism and all sorts of things. So I'm hoping that it will be her first and the first of many times of speaking, because all of her research things are things we're interested in. Can we give her a warm welcome, please? Next, we'll be hearing from Steve Erlanger, who's the London Bureau Chief of the New York Times. I've actually long wanted to get him here. I've asked him once before and he couldn't come, but he's here this year. He's lived in 10 countries, reported from more than 120, some of which no longer exist, he notes. He shared the 2001 Pulitzer Prize for work on Al-Qaeda, was given the Chevalier of the Legion d'Honneur, which I'll never get, by France. And he's a fantastic writer and commentator, and I'm delighted to have him here. Give him a warm welcome, please. Frank, can you kick us off, please? Thanks.
Right. Good morning, everybody. I don't know, but 10, 12 years ago, I was on a panel like this with Francis Fukuyama, who wrote his very famous book on the end of history, and which basically meant that liberalism now triumphed and was beyond debate and discussion. And when he wrote that book and I was looking at it, I was very much struck by a paradox that, if anything, has become even more sort of powerful. And the paradox is that outwardly, liberalism is unquestioned. I mean, people sometimes, sort of react against liberals. But liberalism and the values of liberalism tends to be unquestioned within Western society. And when the government, for example, talks about British values, whatever that means, in their hearts of hearts, what they really are getting at are just the basic old-fashioned values of liberalism, which they kind of brand as British, as opposed to anything else. So outwardly, liberalism is flourishing tremendously. The values are very rarely questioned. But what I find very interesting is that inwardly, liberalism has lost most of its meaning, most of its power. And virtually all the fundamental values that you associate with liberalism are either distorted in the way that they're used, or alternatively subverted and denied of their relevance. One of the things that I feel quite strongly about is the way that the concept and the value of tolerance, which I really strongly hold and believe in, which is one of the most fundamental liberal values, has been rebranded, particularly in the United States, but also in Europe, as the synonym of non-judgmentalism. So that many children learning about tolerance get these non-judgmental classes, that you all have to be non-judgmental, because if you're judgmental, that's horrible. Whereas, in fact, one of the creative dimensions of tolerance, in the way that Locke and later on Mills developed it, was that tolerance was about the fact that you are judging people. It's about you judging people to be wrong in many cases, but nevertheless, even though they're wrong, you're still tolerating them. I mean, that's why people who are liberals, in my view, always occupy the moral high ground, if they genuinely are liberals, because they can tolerate views that they find offensive and horrible and objectionable. And that kind of subversion of the concept, the way that we use tolerance today, is symptomatic of a wider trend. For example, at the moment, I'm working on a history or a study of the idea of autonomy, which is also one of the fundamental principles, the whole idea of self-determination and the fact that you act in a way that it's in accordance with your inclination. And as long as you don't harm other people, and as Kant said, as long as you treat people in the way that you want to be treated, then that kind of self-determination has this incredibly creative, transformative dimension. If you read the books that are written about autonomy today, almost all of them, but 99% of them, devote almost all of their energies towards showing you conclusively that autonomy is a myth. I mean, the number of times I hear people saying, oh, the idea of autonomy is a myth. And the idea that autonomy is a myth, which basically says we lack agency, that that the idea of free will, even in its most weak form, doesn't really mean very much, is almost beyond discussion, certainly in the social sciences. But of course, when people say autonomy is a myth, that always serves as a prelude to saying that in any case, it's not a good idea, because it's ever so individualistic. And autonomy, self-determination, in their eyes, seems to be the antithesis of solidarity. Whereas from a classical liberal point of view, autonomy provides the mediation through which genuine solidarity and genuine community actually becomes constructed. And I suppose what I'm really getting at is that the kind of ideas that are in the air are fundamentally illiberal because, without exception, they project an extremely strong narrative of determinism. I mean, we used to have economic determinism, and we used to have biological determinism, and we used to have natural determinism, and we used to have predestination. Well, today, we have, neurodeterminism, it's your brains that decides who you are. And if you look at the number of new determinisms that have evolved, you almost wonder whether there's anything you can do for yourself, if that's something that, you have the capacity. And of course, if our lives is determined to the extent that it is or is supposed to be, then what is the scope for freedom? Which is, you know, based upon the idea. I mean, freedom isn't a piece of paper. Freedom is actually based on the idea that we can exercise freedom, that we are able to be free individual. And I think that what has happened is that with the subversion of liberal values and the elevation of determinisms, what you end up doing is having an idea of freedom which is paper thin and which is not genuinely experienced. Which is why I think we do live in an era where, by and large, the intelligentsia and the cultural classes are totally devoted to paternalistic ideas, whether it's the form of nudge or whether it's paternalistic ideas in the form of helping us. They use the word support. We're kind of supporting you to make the rational choices. And the number of times I hear people telling us to make the healthy choices or the kind of choices I want you to make and still calling that choice is kind of phenomenal. So what you end up with is a kind of a deterministic world with a kind of powerful paternalistic culture, which actually calls themselves liberal. I mean, when I go to America, you know, the most paternalistic individuals perceive themselves as being liberal, whereas what they project is the most illiberal ideals that directly contradict what this was really all about. So the question then becomes, does liberalism have a future? And I think it's a wrong question to pose, because without liberalism as it was enunciated in the 18th century and in the 19th century, without liberalism, we are in big trouble. And I think one of the things that history has demonstrated is that liberalism is always vulnerable to being contradicted, to being undermined. It's not despite the powerful ideals that it projects forward, it is continually an ideal that is negated by experience, because for a lot of people, genuine liberalism is a very difficult life to lead. I mean, we have to remember that we do talk a lot about freedom as an ideal, we talk about liberty as an ideal, but one of the points that most of us have found, I think Sartre in his writings on existentialism really expressed it really well, we do find it difficult to be genuinely free. I mean, we talk about choices, but people avoid making choices. I mean, that's part of our DNA. You know, we talk about choices only in the narrow sense, but when it comes to the big existential choices, we kind of withdraw from that. And I think that's the reason why we live in a world where liberalism prevails outwardly, but inwardly it is being sort of undermined and subverted by a variety of forces. And it seems to me that the key thing for us and the way forward for people who have genuine liberal inclinations is to uphold one value, which is logically prior to any other liberal values, and that value is that of individual autonomy. I think the individual autonomy is the battleground on which the future needs to be kind of confronted, and people have got to understand that individual autonomy is not about selfish, narrow individualism, but it's the first step towards recognizing that we are human beings with an agency, and that unless we have the recognition of that, that any form of solidarity, any form of community becomes emptied of meaning.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So when we talk about liberalism and its future, we could easily spend an entire session trying to pin down what liberalism is, and I don't want to do that, but I do want to spend a minute thinking about what a longer view of liberalism might look like and what liberalism has meant at various points in its history. So broadly speaking, there are two main ways to think about liberalism. One is a moral or a philosophical view, in which liberalism is about defending a relatively unchanging set of core values. And a second view is a more political view. So what does liberalism mean when it comes to politics? So instead of thinking about free speech, free contract, liberal autonomy, individualism, we can think about what liberalism has meant politically at various different moments. So liberalism has been variously an attitude about compromise, pragmatism, adaptability. It has had a harder political edge as an anti-socialist strategy. For a lot of its history, liberalism has also been about making capitalism livable, so securing and limiting inequality to the extent that capitalism can run smoothly. And liberals have also tried to challenge arbitrary and excess power. Now, the challenge to power has worked through various different institutional mechanisms and structures. The separation of powers, checks and balances, constitutions, these are all paradigmatic liberal institutions. Today, when we think of the challenge to liberalism that liberalism poses to power, we think of it as either a challenge to democratic populism on the one hand or excessive state power on the other. Now, this view is largely a product of liberal battles in the mid-20th century against mass democracy on the one hand and against totalitarian states on the other. Liberalism then became about protecting the rights of the individual against the majority and against the state. But the challenge to power has also taken a number of different forms. Because liberals have been strategists and willing to adapt to historical circumstances, when power changes, liberals have also changed their views. So if you take a longer view and go back to the mid or early 20th century in Britain and America, we can see that liberals acted through the state, not against the state, to challenge forms of corporate and monopoly power beyond the state. They used the state to regulate corporate power and impose order on a disordered economic world. And they used the state to secure the rights of groups, unions, workers, associations, to secure economic rights, the rights to strike or to legislate for civil liberties. Liberalism in these contexts has variously been a way of domesticating dissent, a strategy for diffusing the appeal of state socialism, but also a way of protecting democracy, workers, civil liberties. And this is true whether or not you look at John Stuart Mill, whether you look at the New Deal progressive state in America, whether you look at the early British welfare state. Now, the question of whether liberalism has a future has been asked in all these different historical moments. It gets asked when core liberal values are at stake, but it also gets asked when core liberal institutions seem to be threatened. Now, when worries are raised about the future of liberal values, the reaction tends to be a kind of digging in. Liberals move towards muscular defences of core values, so think of Cold War liberals under the threat of totalitarianism. When worries are raised about liberal institutions, the reaction tends to be a retreat from democracy to technocracy. So the idea that experts, managers, technocrats can use institutions to advance liberal ends. Now, today, most of the worries about the future of liberalism are concerned with values. So there's a lot of anxiety about the student movements, trigger warnings, whether or not liberalism can survive the threat of identity politics. Now, I want to suggest that that's a distraction, and I'm going to take the example of the universities quite briefly. There's been a lot of coverage about the threat to free speech posed by students. But if you ask most academics what the real threat to free speech in universities is, it's the neoliberal university itself, the reframing of education as student experience, employability, the focus on impact, and the ways in which academic labour is being gradually transformed by new learning technologies. These are the threats to free speech. And we can talk about the ways in which these two different sets threats are interrelated, but I think it's important to be clear that when we talk about where the real power lies, it's with the management, not with the students. And the same is really true across our public and private institutions. There are many unaccountable sources of corporate and economic power that act both through the state and above the state. So if liberalism has a future today, I believe that its point should be to identify those sources of power and challenge them. In a post-2008 world, that means challenging global economic hierarchies and financial institutions. It means returning to an idea of liberalism where the state and bureaucracy can be used for liberal and democratic ends rather than neoliberal ends. And it means returning to a state that can legislate for freedom from work, for economic rights and protections on housing, and the kind of liberalism that tries to protect people with policies, say, for universal basic income. But we should also be wary of the tendency to believe that the state can be used for liberal ends by experts and technocrats alone. If liberalism prides itself on being adaptable, I think that at our particular historical moment, those adaptable liberals should ally themselves with democratic movements, because it's only that kind of alliance that can really challenge and tame the power of the current neoliberal state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Brilliant.
Thank thanks. Great.
Loads of things to come back and discuss there as well. So I'm looking forward to that. But Stephen, your thoughts?
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you all for coming. It's a pleasure to be on this fine panel. Every time I go to a different country and cover an election, there's usually something online that asks you your opinions about certain topics and then tells you how you vote. And unfortunately, or fortunately, I'm always a liberal. I'm a free Democrat in Germany. I'm a liberal Democrat here. It reminds me of this, I think it was Tom Lehrer's song, Love Me, I'm a Liberal, which I recommend to all of you. But what I'd like to do in my brief introduction is pull us out a bit, away from the university, even away from Britain, and just think for a minute about the challenge to liberal democracy, let's add that word, as a way of organizing life from the rest of the world, which is growing. I mean, I'm always very struck as an American who's lived many places and now lives here, that the number of countries who actually believe in things like rule of law, private property, market economics, gender equality, sexual freedom is small, and it's not growing, it's shrinking, and it is deeply under challenge. It's under challenge from the Muslim world, it's under challenge from China, which has a whole different set of values, which it may or may not consider universal, but it certainly rejects the idea that our values, our Enlightenment values, are universal values by which everyone must live. And it's under challenge, too, from this new Russia, whatever you think of this new Russia, which is back to some old myths it's had about being the third Rome, about somehow being more Western than the West, more pure than the Pope, but also deeply illiberal in terms of most of its social values. And this I find very, very troubling. I mean, in 89, of course, as everything was falling apart from at least the organized communist side, Fukuyama, who's been mentioned, was very hopeful about the triumph of, you know, Western liberal democracy. He was wrong, but it's okay to be wrong. What he was hopeful. And now, I must say, I don't really share much hope this way. I'm also very struck, you know, that our values, our universal Western values, are regarded by most of the rest of the world as somehow colonial. They're colonial values. They've been imposed upon them. And in some ways, the fight now is less about ideology, since communism, too, was an outgrowth of the Enlightenment, much as Western liberalism was. I mean, communism is basically a Western construction. But there's a big question, it seems to me, on the issue of sexual freedoms and rights. I mean, there's a big part of the world that actually doesn't believe in homosexuality, that thinks it's wrong, thinks it's irreligious, which holds it as a sin, which doesn't believe that women should have full rights with men. There's this kind of sexual divide now, which I find quite strong and building, and is a real challenge to our notion of what a liberal society should be like. And we see it inside our own Western societies, too. I mean, there was, in some of the readings that were suggested, there was a very good point, a very good question here, which is, what are the limits of tolerance for non-liberal cultures within the liberal state? And I think that's one of the questions certainly Britain is facing, Belgium, most of Europe is facing, from its post-colonial immigration, and also from an Islam, which, as we know, is generally pacific and lovely and wonderful, but which has values that are in many ways different. And I'm not talking about radical Islam. I'm talking about ordinary Islam, just different notions of what it is to be a human being within a society. Not bad, I'm not being judgmental here particularly, but they're not what, you know, majority cultures have defined for themselves or pushing on people. So this is part of what actually really worries me. I mean, part of what I've always tried to do, I've just done a profile that's running today of Neil McGregor, who's the head of the British Museum, and who's quite a wonderful man and is probably well known here for his work on Germany, and this quite wonderful radio series and book called Germany, Memories of a Nation. And one of the things that we talked quite a lot about is how he has tried in his work at the museum, also at the National Gallery before, but by his cultural outreach to Russia, China, Iran, sometimes very controversial, to try to help people understand what the world looks like to other people. And I think that, in a way, is, Frank, you talked about tolerance. That's really what we're talking about, which is to try to understand why people feel differently from the way we think they ought to feel, why they reject certain tenets of what we consider to be obvious and natural, which you can wrap up under the idea, I suppose, of Western liberal democracy. And so when we ask what's the future of liberalism, I think part of what we're asking is what is the future of Western values in a world that's changing quite rapidly and not always to the benefit of those values. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Just because we've got a bit of time, let's just have a conversation quickly to bring some of these thoughts together. Frank, do you want to pick up on any of the things that have been said as you spoke first? You might want to have a couple of threads there.
Yeah, I mean, I think on this very last point, so what's very troubling is that in the conduct of what's called the culture war, which is becoming increasingly international, no longer just simply confined to one nation, it's very clear to me that neither side is liberal, you know, and both sides are continually practicing very robust double standards. And if I want to understand the problem of the culture wars and the problem of liberalism, I always think of, I've been doing these speeches on the continent, and every time I go to Amsterdam or I go to a Flemish town, you know, sort of, somebody puts up his hand sooner or later and always asks the same question. And the question is, how can we tolerate the intolerant? And the implication being that because they're intolerant, we shouldn't tolerate them. In other words, what they're saying is that we should fight intolerance with our intolerance. You know, so that seems to be the basic kind of argument. And that usually becomes a way of saying that dialogue is impossible. That what it really means is that we're not confident of our own ideas to be able to argue with them. I got a letter a couple of months ago from a vice chancellor of a university and said, look, Frank, we're having a lot of problems because the students invited this radical Islamic speaker and we can't find anybody who is willing to debate him. Right. And I kind of said, what do you mean you can't find anybody? I mean, there are tens of thousands of academics in the world. Why come to me? You know, this kind of, who's pretty far away. And I realized at that point that this kind of dialogue, these kinds of debates are really not taking place because there really isn't an appetite for what could be a very creative reconstruction of liberal values. Because for me, debating a radical Islamic speaker is an opportunity to state an alternative point of view. And I think that seems to be quite troublesome. I do think that the kind of liberalism that we have is very colonial. As a Hungarian, somebody of Hungarian origin, I do think that almost all of the problems that Hungary has is at least indirectly caused by the way that the EU told the Hungarians what to think, you know, what its values should be, and made sure that only certain kinds of people get money from EU funds if they play the game. And when you do that, and when you basically force people to adopt EU rules on sexuality, on multiculturalism and everything else, and just ram it down people's throat, you know, what you get is what you have in Hungary. And that really wasn't necessary because, there was a lot of other kind of possibilities. So there is a kind of double standard here. And I do worry when people, liberals in England, denounce FGM, say it's really, really horrible. But for somehow, I think it's all right for Europeans to cut their genitals off and pierce themselves here and cut that. That's okay. You know, but when a Kenyan does that, you know, it's kind of immediately has a different, they're being forced to do it, whereas we're doing it, you know, I mean, the discussion is totally colonial in that kind of respect, and we do need a bit of a reality check.
Okay, God. So much controversy there, right? 79 rows. Anyway, right, before we have those rows, but Katrina, one thing that I'm not sure that I agreed with you, but I thought it was interesting about your point about the university and the PowerPoint. But one of the things that I did want you to just clarify, or you know, for myself, let alone the audience, is the different way that liberalism is used in the US and in Europe, because I think that is quite confusing, apart from anything else, or if you'd reflect on that. But is there anything you want to come back on as well, just quickly?
Well, I just wanted to flag something that Frank mentioned in his talk about the avoidance of choice making first. And I think it's important when we talk about the ways in which we avoid choice making to also think about the background conditions that allow us to make choices. And we haven't really heard that much about that. And that gets back to my point of focusing on the institutional structures.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was just something I wanted to flag. And I could talk about the colonialism of liberalism and but I'll leave that. So in terms of the different ways that liberalism is understood in America and in Britain, I do think that in certain respects there are similarities if you look historically, and that's what I was trying to suggest in the early 20th century, when there's a much closer link between certain forms of what we now call social democracy and liberalism than there might be now today in both America and in Britain. But it's different in different contexts. So in Britain, of course, the challenge of the individual to the state is nowhere near as pronounced as it is in an American context. And that's always worth holding up as a major difference. But I do think that in some sense, if we focus just on the ways in which liberalism is understood in party politics, we can miss, which is very different in a British and American context, but we can miss some of the broader similarities.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm trying to grasp is attitude to the state and whether that, I know it's a slightly different level of discussing it than your autonomy point. But the point you made in your introduction was that lots of liberals look to the state. You were making the point about determinism. Mm. And it just seemed to me that there's a confused relationship between liberalism, the state, and individualism. That's what I was trying to kind of pull out. And whether that was different in America or Europe. Anyway, you might want to reflect on that, or anyone. Quick.
Well, I just think that it can historically be very different. Some liberals use the state, some liberals challenge the state. In contemporary America, we see one form of libertarian liberalism, let's call it, as a challenge to the state. But then, of course, the more progressive liberalism of the Democrats is very much about using the state. So I think...
Although I would call that procedural liberalism,
yeah,
which is not liberalism in my... But I mean,
no, but that's why I wanted to say that. Look.
I think that there is that. This is if you move down the procedural road, never mind the state, you rely so much on process that you lose sight of values. And I think that's what happened to American and European liberalism, that they were so devoted to rulemaking that the rule of law is important. But when you extend the rule of law in a way that it has to every domain of life, you do end up basically no longer relying on people having the agency to live according to liberal value, but you entirely rely on them on keeping to the rules.
Okay.
Can I just come back on that very quickly, which is what does the defence of liberal values and liberal agency look like if it's not procedural? I mean, just politically, how does it play out? That was directly to him.
Yeah. One line.
Well, that's a very exciting question, and that's really what we need.
That's what we're here to discuss. Good.
I would just say briefly, I think, you know, basically liberalism is kind of an elite project, and like socialism in this century has become more conservative because it feels itself under threat, and it is trying to preserve, it seems to me, much like socialism, the victories of the last century, which were quite wonderful, but which are very much under challenge from demography, from these societies in which we live, which are not producing the kind of wealth necessary to keep that same kind of social structure, social benefit structure, as we were used to in what the French would call the 30 glorious years. And I think this is one of the great challenges, so that you get, on the one hand, a kind of great nostalgia for a Britain that used to be, whether it's from UKIP on one side or Jeremy Corbyn from another side. And then you have in the Democratic Party in America a fierce fight going on, really, about what it means to defend the working class. What is the working class in this modern age? And how do you get their votes? And why do people who suffer from, call it globalization, post-industrialization, why are they so tempted to vote for the right and not for the left, which I think is one of the great questions that faces all of us, including liberals.
Okay, so let's take a cluster of questions.
Katrina, I thought your talk was really interesting. And I suppose what struck me while you were talking is actually how liberalism can be so many different things, how it's changed over the course of history, how even on this panel, liberalism means something very, very different to each of you. And I suppose my question is liberalism a term that is so broad, so changeable, so ambiguous, that actually it doesn't have an awful lot of meaning?
There seems to be some fundamental sort of inconsistencies or incoherences within our understanding of liberalism. Three that I've identified is how we understand what agency is. For example, Professor Ferretti, you spoke very well about determinism and essentialism, and in the course of doing so actually creates a number of sort of false dichotomies of determining, saying, oh, we have to be either economically essentialist or we have to be culturally essentialist, whereas it seems problematic for us to have to accept a kind of very, very broad idea of circumstantial determinism, potentially, which could explain how we're actually created. Secondly, we don't seem to understand whether we're talking about positive or negative liberty or positive or negative liberalism, a point that was made very well by Mr. Erlinger, talking about wealth and that it's linked to our ability to sort of implement the liberal project. And finally, whether liberalism is a universal term that we can morally apply to the rest of the world and expect from the rest of the world, whether it is a historic cultural experiment that came about as a result of European or Western experiences. These inconsistencies mean that, if nothing else, liberalism remains a badge of legitimacy.
Yeah, the point about tolerating intolerance, I think, is part of a broader point, which is this tension between liberalism, between, on the one hand, asserting universal values, and on the other hand, being tolerant, whatever it might be, or accepting, embracing of diversity of views. Now, I don't think that's a contradiction. There's a tension. It seems there are various ways one could try to resolve it, just to sort of flag up two. One is to say, kind of that bullish kind of way, look, we do have all the right values within liberalism. It's just that one of those values is tolerance. We just have to put up with all you wrong people, but that's fine, you know. At the other end of the spectrum, there's a kind of thing where you might say something along the lines of, well, actually, you know, the truly universal aspect of liberalism is quite broad. It's only a couple of core concepts. And underneath that, there are lots of different other possible values which are compatible with it, or like variants of it and so forth. I mean, they're just two, but I'm curious to know what strategy intellectually panelists have for resolving that tension between the universal and the diverse aspects of liberalism.
First of all, I think liberalism as a badge of legitimacy is nearly what's left of it, and I think what Frank said about this, the paradox of outward unquestioned, remaining unquestioned, but from within we have been corroded, I agree with that. And I think what, in terms of this badge of legitimacy issue, I come to call myself a libertarian because the phrase liberalism and being a liberal has been subverted and inverted, and that's been noticed a long time ago, because we have a classical liberalism that's been often discussed, which stood for individual freedom, entrepreneurship, free market and small state, etc. And then this label has migrated to be stuck on the progressivist project of since the New Deal and taking over the state and post-war era as well, more and more having a state regulated and a state-dominated society and economy. So, and at that point, liberals had to rebrand as libertarians. And I just want to ask Frank if he sees this, what he is defending, he finds more in the space of what is now called libertarianism than in that kind of strangely illiberal, left liberal set of attitudes and values. I want to add one more thing: is when we're talking about the tolerance of the intolerant, I think we need to be, and that not to confuse tolerance with the non-judgmental. I 100% agree with Frank. So we need to be sharply arguing. For me, the dividing line is where you never go into violence, and you don't, and you also keep sharing a platform, potentially, and debating to the limit of aggressive and judgmental stance, but you reject violence and the use of force and state force to kind of, in a sense, substitute for winning the arguments. That's where what I stand is so important, and that's why I also feel that in Katerina's notion.
Quick.
One more point: economic force, for instance, we're blurring this notion of force. And even Frank was, I think, slipping into this. We need to be quite clear about what force means. Force means the use of violence, perhaps state violence.
I notice there's been lack of, in historical discussion, a lack of perhaps a talk about the impact of the economic and military supremacy of the West in spreading liberalism, and in particularly Britain and America, in spreading liberalism through, you know, winning several world wars and the Cold War. And as the economic supremacy of the West and the military supremacy of the West appears to decline, does that mean that liberalism will decline too, inevitably? Thank you.
Seems to me that, like, kind of liberalism's changed from the ideas of, like, liberty to be free from the state and be free from the external, like, violence and pressures of other people, now to be, like, kind of the freedom of the minutiae of everyday life. So the freedom to be free of other people, the freedom to be free of smoke, the freedom to be free of the speech which you find offensive. And then these things are all deferred onto the state. So why is it now that liberalism, you know, you look at the Democrats in America, and the Liberal Democrats here seem to be people of kind of the big state. They want to take away from people with the state and call that liberty.
I mean, obviously, the European notion of liberalism is much more conservative than the American one. I mean, the Dutch Liberal Party is basically very conservative, right? So, I mean, it's an older idea, perhaps, of what liberalism is. Maybe it's a more genuine idea, which is free market, small state, blah, blah, low taxes, right? And as an American, I'm one of these people who, you know, partly as a journalist, too, I don't trust the state. I don't trust politicians. I don't trust state structures. I'd like to live a life as much as possible outside the realm of the state. It's nice to have police and so on. You know, it's nice to have a tube that actually works. It's great. But we pay for those things. I mean, it's not like they're gifts from heaven or something. And I am also, you know, so I think a lot of the implications of the questions are absolutely right, which is we've become very sloppy about what the word means, and also it's transformed itself through power and transformed itself through our own myth-making about how society should be organized. I'm troubled, as I said, and this gentleman here raised it, by the colonial aspect of our notion of universal values, and there is a big fight back. One can feel it. It's been going on for a long time. It's not so much the military supremacy being less, but the world is becoming a more powerful economic place, and the supremacy of the EU and the US, put it that way, in terms of wealth is slowly shrinking. We have to pay more attention to other, to the BRIC countries, blah, 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 countries that actually have different notions of how to set up their societies. And, you know, it's like even Brazil, let's look at Brazil. I mean, you know, Brazil is quite an interesting democracy. It cares about the rule of law. But it also regards, you know, the U.S. foreign policy, let's say, toward Venezuela as deeply hypocritical and colonialist, right? But that doesn't mean it doesn't share a lot of our values about democracy and liberalism, but it resents the power of these World War II inheritors at the UN, at the IMF, all these other places. In other words, the world's changing, and with it, values are changing. The only other thing I would say, you know, we could go on for quite a long time, is I'm very struck by, you know, the impact, which we haven't, I mean, it's sort of obvious to mention it, but it just hasn't come up yet, of the internet and social media on the way we talk to one another and the way we deal with one another, which is somehow not face-to-face, but, you know, through Twitter and things like that. And I remember I was based in Jerusalem for 4 years for the New York Times, which is probably the loneliest job I've ever had, and covering Israel and Palestine. And I used to get the most vicious emails. I cannot tell you just how awful they were. And I used to sometimes write people back and say, "Dear sir, madam, whatever the justice of your argument, how dare you think you can speak to someone you don't even know in such a disgraceful fashion?" And of course, sometimes this would set people off further, you know? But I also got a number of apologies as well. There's just something about the modern world that is cutting into our notions of civility and social behavior, which I think is, you know, an important part of how we rub along in what we like to think of as a liberal society.
Okay, thanks. Anything you want to pick up on, Frank?
Yeah, two very one-sentence points. I don't think that the West has ever exported liberalism. You can't export liberalism, and if you do, the pushback against it will ensure that it will never have any real traction in those societies, and they become superficially thin, a bit like, you know, sort of Christianity when they tried to export that to China. You had a few, you know, sort of what they call rice Christians, but China remained China. I think that's more or less what happens. Having said that, I do think that liberalism is a universal, I mean, not liberalism, but the values that underpin liberalism are universal, and I kind of have got no problems sounding robust about it. I think any, you know, it's the they are the values that capture the human essence. That's why they're so important. And given the fact that Chinese people are human beings just as much as we are, it is something that at one day they will, and many of them already have. I mean, if you go to Shanghai, there are more liberals in Shanghai probably than in London, I would argue, you know, sort of genuine liberals. So we do need to have a sense of proportion in relation to this. I just want to say one thing about this tolerating intolerance business, because I think that's really the nub of it. If you can crack that problem, then we can go a long way. You see, one of the things that we're doing, I mean, so, you know, is that we're trying to get around the issue of genuine tolerance by finding substitutes for it. So in the Anglo-American political vocabulary, we've got this horrible concept that we use, which is diversity. I don't know if you... Everybody, diversity. Every time anybody in the university says diversity, everybody rolls over. This is the most wonderful value. We have diversity officers. But actually, it's a completely zombie category. I mean, what is diversity other than the fact that there are many of us? And, you know, it's like worshiping the rise of the sun. Oh, isn't that interesting? What a wonderful value. The sun has risen. Diversity. And it's never a question, but we have all these zombie categories, and I can give you a lot more that we use as a way of getting around the fact that tolerance is a really difficult accomplishment. I mean, genuine tolerance is very difficult to do, which is why we always find very good reason as to why tolerance does not apply in this particular kind of circumstances, and why we should somehow withdraw, you know, the permission that tolerance gives in this and this particular area. And I think that, you know, in many respects, if you believe in tolerance, then you need to join me in a campaign to rehabilitate the idea of judgmentalism. I think we've got to fight non-judgmentalism as a very insidious, creepy concept. And actually, you know, we've got to take judgmentalism seriously. If you read the writings of Hannah Arendt, you know, there's one point that she makes which is absolutely beautiful. And she makes the point that if I don't judge you, that's my way of saying I'm not taking you seriously. You know, I'm indifferent to your views. It's in the very act of judging one another that we make, you know, sort of statements about each other, that the basis for the development of a public sphere of a dialogue can actually emerge. And it goes completely against the grain in which we now think of liberalism being. Liberalism has always been a very various concept. The first time I ever heard the word liberal, I was 16, talking to a bunch of right-wing, you know, semi-fascist, who told me I was a New York liberal. This was in Montreal, Canada. I had no idea what a New York liberal was. I later discovered I was a Jew, you know, so kind of, I thought it was a very interesting kind of concept. And since then, I heard many, many variations of it. But that doesn't detract from the fact that there is a certain fundamental essence to it, which we use differently. I think it's quite legitimate to be left-wing liberal. I mean, I would call myself, I'm not a middle-of-the-road liberal by any means. I would see myself as on the left as much as you possibly can go. There are right-wing liberals, and there are, you know, wishy-washy, which is most liberals who kind of, you know, never get up in the morning, you know, because it's too dangerous.
Right, thank you.
I'm just going to quickly pick up on the point about negative and positive liberty and the liberty from the state and against the state, because I think that we can get too hung up on this distinction, first of all conceptually because it doesn't hold that much water, but also because historically the idea that there was this classical liberalism and then suddenly the state came along and co-opted liberalism is just part of the myth-making that, you know, that we tell ourselves. And actually, if you take one example that just occurred to me while you were talking about libertarianism, if you look at the American libertarian ecological movement, the idea of wilderness, so important as wilderness that's free from the state, where does the wilderness come from? The laws of the state created the safe space for the wilderness to exist. And so I think that we can get, in terms of talking historically about the development of liberalism, too hung up on the distinction between these different ways of being free from the space, free from the state. I also just quickly wanted to come back to the point about procedural liberalism, which is that I think when I asked my question, what is the alternative? Really, if you want to talk about agency and choice making, you're kind of talking about democracy in some way, and you're talking about movements and of various kinds. And I do think that that's one of the other complicated ways in which you can think about the relationship between individuals and the state, which is interpolated by different kinds of associations, unions, etc. And that is what Mill thought. So Mill's defense of autonomy was always, well, not always, but at various points, autonomy within these communal associations and unions. So I think it's a little bit more fluid, the categories, than just the liberty from, liberty to.
I wanted to just come back on the two people at the beginning who sort of said, you know, is it sort of so everything that it was nothing? I think you have to be very careful about that, but I actually think it does go to one of the things that was said earlier about how liberalism has become quite a hollow concept, because I think that's one of the problems, is it has become a badge. People wear the badge differently, and it's become, it seems to me that, you know, as I said, I can use it to insult people, I can be insulted by being called a liberal and so on. I've done over the years quite a lot of debates with people who are actual radical Islamists and Hizb ut-Tahrir and things like that on university campuses in defiance of bans and so on. And of course, what they thoroughly enjoy doing is saying, oh, liberalism doesn't mean it. And the problem then is that they say, oh, that's just, it's all very well the ideal, but you never live up to that ideal. And what they then do is show all of the attacks on free speech that liberals do and so on and so forth. And they've got a point, haven't they? But actually, that's because of the point that Frank made, I think, which is it's become hollow term, but the values associated with liberalism won't be fought for by people who call themselves liberals. And so consequently, it's hard to defend that hollow man. And it can therefore be used in all sorts of ways. I think we need a more robust view of what it is and an absolutely robust defence of the values, unapologetically. And I think that's what's lacking from a lot of the discussion on liberalism.
I was just about to ask the panel why they feel that liberals seem so unwilling to march behind banners. I just recalled a question time that I saw in 2007... And it was just after Salman Rushdie had received a prize for literature. And they were discussing the prize and whether it should have been given. And Shirley Williams' perspective on it was that it was poor timing and that the prize shouldn't have been given. And it resulted in a backlash of the other liberals on the table who said, you know, we're talking about, you know, someone trying to murder one of our novelists, the British novelist. Are we not going to get angry about this? And Shirley Williams was quite
unwilling to do so. And that, to me, is part of the problem of liberalism.
My point is just with you, Frank, when you mentioned how you used to get hate emails, and especially in the context of social media, with Twitter having 140 characters, it's a great platform to show how tolerant and intolerant you can be at the same time. So in the very naive sense, it's a very liberating way of expressing your views on either side. And I think social media sort of let that out because you can stop beating about the bush and go ahead and do it.
Okay, so I'm pretty young, so my window of observation is pretty small, but maybe the panel can confirm or refute my impression that what has changed is our perception of the ends justify the means. So have we become more instrumentalist in the sense that we accept that a noble aim like reducing obesity is can now be used to justify the most outrageous new laws, for instance? So we all accept in principle there is some limit. For instance, we wouldn't pass a law that we shoot everyone who drives over the speed limit. But have we become much more accepting in what we think justifies the means? And if so, why?
Liberalism becomes real with some of the tensions that come out in terms of the practice of everyday life. And one of the biggest times I saw one of these contradictions was working in a newsroom on a national newspaper a few years ago, and I was doing the evening shift, and a story dropped, as we call it, at the last minute, and so we were going to have to rip out all our pages and completely change our whole section. And the story that dropped was that a man in an American military jail had been convicted of stealing secrets, put out a press release and said that he was no longer a man, he was no longer called Bradley, he was called Chelsea. And there were lots of photographs around of a man, this man, Bradley Manning, in a blonde wig. So it was fantastic for newspapers. So we were ripping out all the pages, and then suddenly this huge row erupted, a really bitter row. People were shouting and screaming. I've never seen anything like it. People were weeping because of their anger and the fury that this issue aroused. And the issue was, should we, in this newspaper, which was the Daily Telegraph, should we call this man Chelsea, as he wanted, or should we call him Bradley, which was his real name? Should we call this man a woman, even though he's a man, just because he wants to be called a woman? And this went right up to what we call the stone, when we actually fix the page with this huge war going on as to whether Bradley Manning was a man or Chelsea Manning, who was a woman. And I stuck up very strongly for the rules and the standards of a newspaper, which was that Bradley Manning is still Bradley Manning until he changes his name legally, and while he's still a man, he's a he for our newspaper. Now, was I being illiberal, or was I being liberal? But I've never seen, on that particular issue, it's the one issue where I've really seen people freak out and melt down because they couldn't cope. And this is a national newspaper. We're dealing with a press release where a man says he wants to be called a woman named Chelsea.
So basically, it's a follow-up from the gentleman's question. So liberalism came along and flourished in a specific intellectual environment in what we call the Age of Reason, which assumed that there is something that is true and something that is false. So people kind of decided that it's better to be free rather than being coerced. But today, because we live in an age where we are taught that the primacy lies not with reason, but with emotion, then, for example, what matters not truth, but what I think is happening. For example, Spike's editor, Brendan O'Neill, went to a university, and there were some people holding candles in memoriam of transgender people who died, who were killed, actually, by Brendan O'Neill. Of course, Brendan hadn't killed anyone, but they perceived it this way, so that's all what mattered. Or there are people, for example, in Greece that claim that cars or waking up on Monday is violence. Okay, so the question is, if what has priority is not reality, but what I feel, then in such an intellectual environment, is there any place for liberalism? Because obviously liberalism is based on reality, and reality sometimes hurts.
I'd like to ask Frank a question. You said that liberalism, it will kind of, a unit values are universal, etc. But how much are they actually linked to the economic system of the time? For example, classical liberalism emerged directly and kind of symbiotically with industrial capitalism. And as you, you know, see this, things arrive, like there are certain things in liberalism, in classical liberalism, which seems almost inextricable from capitalism, such as the defence of free market, which John Stuart Mill was very passionate about and many other liberals are. Are we saying that if these values are universal, does that mean modern capitalism is universal? And how does the economic system link? When we have, if we had a new economic system, would liberalism still mean anything, or could it then be carried on?
Hi, it's a question for Katrina. I wondered if you could clarify your comments about liberal values in academia. It's a point I hear a lot now. You said something like, well, people complained about the students, but the real threat to free speech is from the management class. And it seems like you're sort of setting up a false dichotomy, because I think anyone who denies that students are organising in such a way that not only endangers but eradicates free speech is just simply not paying attention. So it'd be nice if you could clarify what you meant there and whether you were setting up that false dichotomy, and if not, what you meant.
I think technology has been slightly overlooked so far. Stephen, you hinted towards it and talking about internet and means of communication, and Katrina, you did as well in talking about technocrats. But I was just wanting to gauge the panel's views on the upcoming Investigatory Powers Bill, which, you know, could be one of the greatest assaults to liberal values. The monitoring and the interception of communications data, you know, surely that could resemble Foucault's panopticon going forward.
This is a question, actually, and it echoes the one from the back about student unions, because it seems to me that student unions in this country are some of the most illiberal organisations that are around at the moment, and I wonder how the panel think that we account for that now, that really they're just all about controlling students, projecting them as being quite vulnerable, needing support and help and controlling, basically. And they're the very organisations that were quite the opposite a few years ago. And I know Claire, who herself led occupations of campuses, you know, what happened to students?
Okay, the term liberal democracy, I'm up here in the corner, you can't see me. The term liberal democracy has been used a few times, which I'd like to ask a question about. I'd want to know if you think there's an inherent tension between the principles of democracy and the principles of liberalism, because it's a term that's often bandied about, and it's often used to justify actions of states and of individuals. So it's key that we define whether or not the principles of liberalism and democracy are contradictory. So the question is, on the one hand, you have this notion of democratic legitimacy, which is basically on the side of the majority, which can often be tyrannical. The majority can tyrannise the individual, and that was one of the core principles of classic liberalism. And on the other side, obviously, you've got this notion that the individual is sacrosanct. So the individual, in spite of what the majority says, may be correct, which echoes this chap's point about reality, the truth. So you have to justify your position. So I want to know if the panel thinks there is an inherent tension between the principles of liberalism and democracy, and if so, what are they?
Okay, leading on from this man's question, I'd like to ask about the fluidity of liberalism and the compatibility with democracy and overall the worldview, because could non-democratic states still embrace liberalism? Is liberal despotism an option, or is this just a fundamentally incongruous notion?
I know we've moved on to a bit of a university theme, but as a student, it does seem to me that it is the students themselves who are imposing kind of liberal values onto the universities and onto the university's management rather than the other way around. But also I was wondering how best, when there's such a vocal majority of people who are supporting liberal views, how best can you kind of battle against that, and how can you promote liberal ideas when everyone around you is shouting them down?
So I did my BA and just finished my MA at Queen Mary, and I found that in the, you know, humanities department, and I found that you can discuss, you know, particularly with feminism, you can discuss very nuanced kind of ideas and subtleties, but there was never much appetite for instance, talking about FGM. And I was just wondering what people think about whether or not cultural relativism is legitimate to bemoan or dangerous.
I was reading Ruth Benedict's book the other day, Patterns of Culture, and in that she talks really interestingly about an idea of tolerance. And I just thought that there was kind of something missing in a kind of dialectic of, if you're looking for some sort of higher value, some sort of liberal value, that actually demonstrating that tolerance of other views is part of the dialectic that enables you to hold those values in the first place. So if you don't have that tolerance, surely you can't enter into any sort of liberal idea or indeed holding those values. On the student thing, I think it's come in a very complex way from two places. I think a lot of students are trying to, I'm a student myself at the moment, are trying to create the idea of safe spaces, and in doing so, excluding a lot of people from entering a safe space. And then from the management side, it seems that they are also trying to support the student voice. And unfortunately, the student voice isn't representing all of the students.
Anything you want to reflect from the audience, and then I'll give you a chance to also give your final point, right? And get too back to the jury here. So, Heather-Ain, anything you want to pick up? And then...
I just want to say that I think there are lots of different things that we're worrying about with students and universities. One is unions, student unions, questions of free speech, no platform. These are older concerns. It may be have changed recently in terms of how many issues like this we're hearing about, but the question of no platforming is not new. The second question is about trigger warnings and safe spaces. Now, when I mentioned blaming the management rather than blaming the students, I don't want to suggest, and I try to imply, that they are related issues, but I think if you look at where the power lies, it isn't with the students. The students are often getting many of their categories from a university system that wants to treat them as consumers and because they pay academic wages. So in terms of academic freedom, rather than the general free speech issues that you get with no platforming questions, which I think are separate but also involve things like, should journalists who also have many other platforms necessarily have a right to speak at small private organisations, etc. I mean, these are huge issues, and I'm sure we'll be hearing lots about them over the weekend. But I do think that that is a different issue from the question of academic freedom and freedom in the classroom and safe spaces. And I think in those situations, I'm not saying there isn't a problem, and there are many problems we can talk about with some of the trigger warning issues, partly the way they take on a neoliberal mental health model that argues that you should not ever revisit past kinds of trauma. But I do think that those issues, even though they come maybe coming from students, the categories are from the neoliberal university that gives us the categories of student experience. And just to add one quick point, if a student came to me in a class and said, I wish you'd put a trigger warning on this, I was upset and offended by this, I'd much rather have an argument with them about the value of the book that they were reading than try and give an account to a university administrator about why our work is valuable.
Okay. It's a very interesting problem, because Katrina is actually right when she says that the initial impulse behind the extremely dreary intellectual and freedom atmosphere in higher education is an accomplishment of management. And I've written at great length about the way in which the introduction of auditing technologies, of learning outcomes, of the way that teaching is organized, actually short-circuits the key element of academic freedom, which is, you know, an open-ended process of teaching and interacting with the students. So there's a dynamic which you cannot reduce to these technologies without violating it. I think management has also played a role in changing academia. I think academics have internalized a lot of that stuff, particularly the younger generations, who actually think this is best practice now. And in the course of internalizing it, have also adopted a whole range of very illiberal values. And I think one of the, you know, the points that you need to remember is that the reason why students are reacting like this is partially because they're being infantilized fairly systematically by the system of education. And the way that the idea of student experience has emerged as a kind of alternative to education. I mean, it's not education anymore. We're being judged on the student experience, you know, and that can mean a variety, but the most important thing is that students should feel good, which goes completely against my pedagogy, which is I'm there to give them a hard time. I mean, unless you give students a hard time, you're not actually doing your job. So what that then has is a situation where the student body defines radicalism by being a little bit more infantile than the norm. And I do think what we now have is a situation which is unprecedented. I mean, the reason why I came to England, because I was involved in a student occupation in Canada, and I was blacklisted for every single sort of postgraduate program. I had to come to England to get it. I mean, we used to have serious occupations in those days, and we didn't think of ourselves as looking for safe spaces, but going to very unsafe areas. That would have been what you're trying to do. Whereas now what you've got is a situation where, for the first time, students are actually asking to be protected, you know, in a way that is a kind of very powerful sense of self-censorship. And I think that is a very troublesome phenomenon, because it's not really a mental health issue in their eyes. It is really a performance, because when you say you want a trigger warning, you're actually performing this. You know, I am very serious. I'm aware. That's really what you're saying. I am aware. Take me seriously. Now, you raised the question about what do you do about it. And I think that a lot of intelligent people are extremely cowardly. And they basically see that because you get shouted down at unions, and because you know you get a lot of hassle from people, and because very often if you, for example, when those kids in Oxford try to have this magazine for offending people, they get shut down. I think that's the point at which you yourself have got to start breaking the rules. And you don't have to play the game that's been assigned. You don't have to. The unions, you know, are not God's creation, right? You don't have to play the game. And I think you can subvert it in all kinds of ways by making yourself hurt. And I think, you know, one thing I've discovered through my experience is that very often it's an emperor no clothes situation. You know, as long as people, you know, don't point out that these guys are naked, and really have no substance behind it, you know, they will carry on, and that kind of, you know, sort of almost like kind of sacred way that they talk about safe spaces will become not violent. But actually, at the end of the day, you know, there is no reason, you know, why alternatives cannot be built.
Okay.
Just one thing. The one liberal classical liberal value that I don't think we should uphold anymore is the one thing that somebody mentioned there, which is the fear of the tyranny of the majority. I think that's the downfall of classical liberalism, that it became so anti-democratic that it's totally lost the way. And I think liberals need to be comfortable with majorities, with mass movements, and have got to learn to win them over to liberal ideas rather than adopt this very elitist, you're a shit kind of attitude. I think that's always been a bad thing.
Can I respond really? I actually want to defend students, because I think that we're also imposing different categories on them, and there is a difference between demanding classrooms be safe spaces and using safe spaces as a tool for mobilisation. And actually, if you look back at where the idea of the safe space comes from, which is radical feminism in the early 70s, there were two different models of the safe space. One was a non-judgmental safe space, and one was not a non-judgmental safe space. But the idea of safe space is that they created solidarity as a tool of movement building. So first, I don't think that we should be careful about which ones we're talking about, because they're doing very, very different things. And also, very quickly, I actually don't think that trigger warnings are the worst thing in the world, but maybe that is... I think that if you think about, do you have a problem with the 9 o'clock, with the watershed? Maybe you do. Do you have a problem with... having a thing on a TV show that says that there's going to be violence in it? Maybe you do, but I don't think when I'm teaching, if someone says to me, I'd like a trigger warning on that kind of a thing, if that's all it is, of course we get into slippery slope arguments, but I don't think that that's that big a deal.
Obviously, this is a row brewing.
I'm actually reminded why I left the academy, to be honest, and went out into the world, such as it is, which may be a suppositional place. I don't know. I was struck by the question about whether liberalism and democracy were somehow contradictory. And I wanted to talk about that for a second, because I don't think they are. I do think the idea of a liberal democracy has content. It's not a democracy pure. It's not liberalism pure. It is a democracy that respects certain things we call liberal values, which I care about, which are law, tolerance, individual freedoms, that kind of thing. There are lots of democracies, so-called, that are not liberal. I mean, Russia would be one. You can think of others, lots of others. Some would even argue now Hungary is, though I think that may be slightly unfair, but maybe it's heading that way. So I do think, you know, these are things that we have to protect. I was very interested, I was doing a piece about universal values, and some of you may know Robert Cooper, who was a very good British diplomat and wrote a really good book about the breaking of nations. He kind of invented the idea of failed states, or at least labeled them. And one of the things, you know, he was trying to make the point was, you know, we talk about democracy is a universal value, but then asked, you know, when it was that women in Italy got the vote, which of course was 1945,
in France, I think it was 44. And when did blacks in the American South get the vote? You could argue it wasn't really until 1965 and the sort of Comprehensive Voting Act. But at the same time, he said, even though people don't necessarily understand or share our values, most people in the world want to live in our societies. And why is that? I mean, we're full of contradictions, but basically because they can live better, they don't have to lie all the time, we're not so corrupt. So maybe it's wrong to talk of universal values, even liberal values, but the societies we've created out of them are universally attractive. And I think that's an important point. You can't replicate them very easily. You can't impose them on people. I mean, there are lots of places where democracy won't take root, and we know how complicated it is. And we know how hard it is to defend it. I mean, someone brought up the question of surveillance. And I think that's a very serious question. You know, I mean, what is, I mean, how far do we let the state go without real oversight in the name of protecting us? And these are, you know, current issues, they're liberal issues, they're questions about the size of the state, they're questions about how we define our freedoms and what we're willing to sacrifice for protection. Because, of course, we're all willing to sacrifice something for protection, right? Don't shout fire in a crowded theater, for instance. But these are whole new questions, I think. And then I'm very struck by Bruno's newsroom tale about Chelsea Manning, because I'm not sure how we resolved it. I wasn't in our newsroom that day, but I think in the end, you know, Bradley, who wishes now to be known as Chelsea, but because we use honorifics, you know, Mr. Manning, you know, I think we used Mr. Manning for a couple of days and then switched to Ms. Anyway.
Yes, right.
Typical
one
liberal.
One sentence each, final sentence on liberalism before we go.
Just one point on the trigger warning thing that hasn't been raised, which is that it's not the trigger warning that's the problem, but the fact that it's a prelude to censorship. So now, in the sociology A level in this country, we've taken Suicide, which is a classical text, Durkheim's Suicide, is a fundamental text to sociology, on the ground that the subject of suicide is going to potentially traumatize many A level students. And I predict that trigger warnings are going to go much further. They are inherently insidious, and they serve as a prelude to actually sort of abolishing certain texts, or at least keeping them for postgraduate students in certain circumstances. And I do think that it might seem like a very trivial issue, but of anything that I've come across in 40 years of experience in academia, this is by far the most insidious and the most corrosive of intellectual life that I can think of, because it ultimately short-circuits the ability of students to take themselves seriously as partners in an academic enterprise.
Okay, thanks. Catherine?
I'm not saying that he's wrong. I think that it's... I don't think it's clear, and I do think that actually that hasn't been the case when you look at various other kinds of potentially very censorious things like TV warnings, let's call them. Anyway, but that's not really what I want to focus on. I want to say that I do think that if we are caring about a future for liberalism, then we really should also be talking about the ways in which we should be challenging power. And I think that in many respects, the biggest issue for liberals right now remains inequality, and talking about the economic structures that allow us to have the kind of liberal values that you've been talking about. And that's something that we haven't really mentioned today. And I think that going forward, we should be serious about how to do that institutionally, as well as protecting liberal values at the same time.
In a sentence, I think these values, even if we disagree on the edges of them, are vital to ourselves as civilizations, and we should defend them and stick with them and not undermine them, whether domestically where they are at risk or abroad where they're under challenge. So go out and fight. That's my view.
Thank you very much.